As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
It's Straight Out of Cobham, the show about Chelsea FC from The Athletic. On this episode, a game to forget but a finish to remember at Selhurst Park. Ziyech proves his worth, but it's another difficult outing for Lukaku. We preview the return of the Champions League to Stamford Bridge and round up the rest of the Chelsea news. Available for free wherever you get your podcasts and ad-free on The Athletic. This is Straight Out of Cobham. Here we go again, then another week in the life of Chelsea Football Club. Hope you're well, listener. It's me, Matt Davis-Adams, joined today by The Athletic's Liam Toomey.
Turns out it wasn't just Simon jet-lagged from Abu Dhabi. Hello.
No, I think everybody was, weren't they? Also with us, fresh off his triumph in the Intertotally quiz on the Totally Football show, which you'll be able to hear later today, it's Dom Fifield. I've just kind of spoiled it for you, spoiled the result for the listener there, Dom, but I was just so pleased for you because it was not just a win, it was an absolute whooping.
You get all the credit, Matt, for putting me through my paces on a Thursday quiz, usually losing to Sam. So thank you so much.
Yeah, no, backing in the next round as well, until you and I, you know, should we come head-to-head, in which case it's war.
Well, you've got to get rid of Michael Cox to do that, though, haven't you? Let's be honest.
Yeah, that's what everybody's looking at. You can listen to that, by the way. It'll be out later today, and do check out how Dom and I get on in the quiz. Won't take you very long to see how I get on. Right, first up today, we're going to reflect on Chelsea's late show at the Palace.
Alonso. Had one disallowed. I think this one will stand, and he'll score for the third league game in a row.
We lack a bit rhythm and we lack a bit fluidity in our match, in our game, and we struggle a bit to create a lot of chances and dangerous attacks. But at least we're trying and we're not giving in, and we're fighting for that one decisive goal. We're fighting for that one decisive chance, and I'm happy that we made it with a bit of luck very late, but not undeserved, I would say.
Crystal Palace 0, Chelsea 1 then. The Blues pinching the points in a truly dreadful game of football, courtesy of Hakim Ziyech's last-minute winner. Both Liam and Dom were on hand for The Athletic. Liam, am I right, first of all, to describe it as a truly dreadful game of football, or am I slightly over-egging the pudding?
No, it was pretty bad. it was a kind of classic Chelsea game against the low block. Palace lined up with no true strikers, defended very deep, very narrow. And as we've seen many times before, Chelsea really struggled to break that down. And in the end, they made the breakthrough with Ziyech. I thought, you know, they looked a little bit more dangerous after some of the substitutions with about 15 minutes left. But it was another really laboured attacking performance, kind of capped by the latest episode in the Romelu Lukaku saga.
Yeah, we'll come on to Lukaku soon enough. I wanted to talk about the starting lineup elsewhere first. Dom, I know you were kind of, you were obviously looking at the Crystal Palace angle for this game, but what do you think, and what do you think Patrick Vieira thought when he saw that Chelsea team, which turned out to have what? Andreas Christensen as a nominal right wing back and Malang Sarr as a left wing back and Christian Pulisic in the 10, and it was all a bit weird and random.
I suspect that's what he thought was going to happen, as in when he actually saw the lineup. But the way it actually worked out was pretty much from the start, a back four with Christensen playing at right back and Sarr at left back, and Pulisic in this sort of weird midfield, central midfield role, which I don't think really worked, considering how much damage he's inflicted on Palace from wide in his Chelsea career to date. It seemed a bit of a waste, and he got lost a bit in the sort of midfield battle over the course of the afternoon. I mean, Liam and I had a conversation halfway through the first half wondering whether Kai Havertz and Christian Pulisic might swap, because Havertz on the left seemed a bit wasted as well. He had some moments of class. And my word, I'd forgotten how excited Liam gets whenever he watches Kai Havertz in the flesh as well. but he did, he had a bit more about him, certainly a bit more about him than Lukaku did up top. But it just felt like a team that had been put together after, you know, losing a couple of players in training on the Friday. And I'm sure they wouldn't have planned to play Christensen at right back. But then when Azpilicueta gets his knock on the Friday, that basically means he has to improvise. And actually, the moments that Palace had, the joy that they had was in the first half, were largely from balls placed, they're bypassing the back line and into the space behind Christensen, because he struggled to deal with Zaha running into that area. So it was an opportunity for Palace to exploit. But, you know, Chelsea stuck at their guns, and the way they do, they're rugged. And it helps when you've got, you know, two defenders, central defenders in Thiago Silva and Antonio Rudiger, who are just outstanding in aspects of every aspect of their play, to be honest, at the moment.
Liam, how surprised were you to see Malang Sarr chosen ahead of Marcos Alonso? And was that because it was more of a back four than wing-backs?
Yeah, I think so. I think, we've seen numerous times in his Chelsea career that Marcos Alonso is a very different player as a full-back than as a wing-back. And, you might get the same level of offensive output from him, but it will come at a cost at the other end of the pitch in terms of your solidity. And it just felt like, you know, Tuchel with that setup prioritized the defense, prioritized guarding against counterattacks, and that was fine. I mean, Palace still had a couple of very good chances, but on the whole, Chelsea controlled the game pretty comprehensively. They just didn't have anywhere near enough to break them down, and perhaps with the back four being what it was, that was why he picked Havertz on the left rather than Pulisic, because maybe the thinking was that a natural left footer might provide a bit more of the width that you would be losing from an overlapping fullback than Pulisic would provide. I just didn't really get the theory of what Chelsea were trying to do in the final third. And it obviously didn't match up in terms of the supply lines to Lukaku, you know, seven touches, remarkably low figure. Chelsea Twitter made its own judgments. He's been tried and convicted in the court of public opinion long ago, I think. But the reality was a lot more complicated than that.
All right, well, let's talk about that a little bit more then, because obviously everybody's seen the stat that's going around. He opted tweeting, Romelu Lukaku had just seven touches against Crystal Palace. If you were in a single Premier League game for a player with 90-plus minutes played since this data is available in full for the competition, one of those touches was from kickoff in the first half. Quiet. Liam, obviously this was the focus of your post-match piece for The Athletic. Kind of general consensus is that the blame should be shared around between Lukaku, between Tuchel, maybe between his teammates too. But what's the way out of this? Because Tuchel, Lukaku and Chelsea are all responsible for finding a solution, aren't they? And the solution is not going to be sell Romelu Lukaku at the end of the season, because he's 28 and he cost £100 million. So he has to be integrated into this team in some form or fashion in a much more effective way than he has been, doesn't he?
That's the way I've felt for weeks. And, you know, I've been of the view for quite a long time that, you know, the more time that Lukaku gets on the training pitch, And in matches with maybe a more consistent set of forwards around him, that things will improve. But Palace was the first time, particularly after I came home and watched the game back in full from my piece, that I felt this just doesn't work. This just doesn't fit. And I'm not sure if it can change. Not for the first time, but it was more emphasized because of the way Palace defended very deep and very narrow. It was just so obvious that Lukaku was trying to do completely different things from the rest of the team. Time and again, Chelsea had the ball and Palace let Chelsea's defenders have the ball, particularly Rudiger. So he was the one kind of making the most decisions in possession. And time and again, when Chelsea were working the ball from left to right, Lukaku was trying to call for passes in behind. Now, you can argue about how realistic that was against the team defending quite deep, but the fact that he was looking for those passes kind of highlighted just the different ways in which Chelsea's number nine and the rest of the team are wired right now. And there were lots of other examples in the game of Chelsea getting the ball in slightly promising positions where there was a window to advance it into Lukaku and maybe isolate him against the defender with a fast sort of direct pass. And they prioritised keeping possession and building things up more slowly. And that's fine. That's a way of playing. But Lukaku obviously wants to play a completely different way and is wired to play a completely different way in terms of what he's done under Conte over the last 2 years. And so the fact that he ends up with seven touches, I think, reflects really badly on everyone involved. It reflects badly on Lukaku's inability to kind of adapt his game and try and do different things, particularly when playing against teams defending the way Palace did. It reflects badly on Chelsea because, you know, what did they think Lukaku would be when they signed him? What did they expect him to be? This was the striker that he was at Inter. And part of me thinks that if you had Diego Costa in this Chelsea team, we'd be having a very similar conversation because he thrived under Conte and Mourinho in teams that kind of played fast transitions. And, you know, he latched onto long balls in behind from Fabregas and things like that. This doesn't happen in this Chelsea team. They're trying to play a very different way. And you need a very different style of number nine for that. It's just an ugly mess that I think reflects really badly on everyone. And I don't actually know how it gets solved now, because it won't always look as bad as it did against Palace. There will be teams that, you know, give Lukaku a bit more space. He will score more goals. Chelsea probably won't pay for it in the Premier League because they look in a pretty strong position in the top four race anyway. But this team is not going to be maximised this way. And since Lukaku was dropped for the Liverpool game after that interview, he started 10 consecutive games. So the argument that this just needs time is a lot harder to make now. There has been time, and the fact that it was still so disjointed against Palace, I wonder if it looks this bad every day in training. Are they trying to do different things in every session? Because if it looks this bad on the pitch now, I just don't see how it improves with more time.
I take everything that Liam said there. He's spot on. But there are a couple of things. I mean, Liam makes a point in his piece that maybe it's not what you want from a £100 million player, but Lukaku does have a role to play in the winning goal. He attracts two defenders towards him and allows Ziyech more space at the back post to convert the decisive goal in the game. There was a moment in that match where a pass was played forward for Lukaku, the type of pass that he relishes. Kovacic's first touch upon his introduction after 74 minutes slides the ball in between down a channel alongside a defender, cuts the defender out. Lukaku is liberated, has a shot from which Ziyech scores. But Lukaku, possibly because he's only had, he may have had all his seven touches by then, I don't know. But he's probably a bit anxious. Probably knows. He must know that he's played a pretty peripheral role in the match, and he's gone slightly too early with the run and therefore offside, and the goal gets chalked off by VAR. But that would suggest to me that Chelsea still can play to his strengths if they want to. any of those midfielders look up and play those balls down the channels. The other thing is that maybe Chelsea have two different number nines now with very different styles. One will suit some circumstances and one which will suit the other. And Kai Havertz is probably that other number nine. Maybe he will, I mean, recap some of his better moments from last season. Maybe he could operate in that role and Lukaku could come in when maybe they're up against a defence that isn't quite so compact or isn't quite so narrow. I don't know. Maybe a squad should have two different types of forwards like that. But the problem with that, of course, is that you spent £100 million on one of them. And therefore, the fee alone demands that player, I want to say pulls up some trees, but the one next to me looks as if it might fall down at any moment. So, you need a well-rounded squad. You need different types of options. They probably have got different types of options. One of them isn't firing particularly. You could argue that both of them actually aren't firing, you know, brilliantly at the moment. But better to have options than not.
If you want to play this kind of high possession, pin the other team back, control the ball in their half as much as possible and build up slowly, this kind of style of football, then, yeah, Havertz is much more suited to being the number nine because you need someone who can basically be a false nine, and not a false nine as in never touching the ball, a false nine as in dropping short, pulling players out of position, acting as basically a number 10 as well as a number nine. Lukaku's never been that guy. You know, if it feels like in order to unlock what he does best, yeah, there might be sort of isolated passes like the one that Kovacic played that can set him free a little bit more. But in order to get the best out of him, Chelsea might actually have to sort of drop 10 and 15 yards, let the other team come out a little bit, then win the ball and try and hit them early. But it just doesn't seem like that's completely incompatible with the way Tuchel has built this team. He's built this team to dominate in the opposition half and to control games with possession and limit opposition chances to move up the pitch as much as possible. So you are denying, and this is not just the case with Lukaku, it's also part of the reason Werner struggled, because he hasn't had that kind of space to run into either. So at some stage you have to question the sort of grand picture of recruitment here and team building. Why do Liverpool sign Diogo Jota and Luis Diaz and they just come in and immediately look brilliant? It's not just because, yeah, they're obviously talented players, but Chelsea have signed talented players. Players who've looked great in other teams, and I'm pretty confident if they left tomorrow, would look very good in other teams. It's because Liverpool get the grand picture right in terms of signing players that fit into what they want to do, and they don't ask them to do anything they're not good at. It feels like Chelsea have signed a £100 million striker who's succeeded a certain way for a decade and are now asking him to do something completely different and to be a different type of player. And it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make a lot of sense if you're considering his forte to be counter-attacking and Timo Werner's to be counter-attacking, and the vast majority of games Chelsea will play in the Premier League won't be counter-attacking performances. They will dominate the ball against virtually all the teams in the division other than the other members of the elite. On the Liverpool thing, I think we should just chill out a bit on that. He's had a good start, but Minamino was meant to be the world beater and he's hardly pulled up any tree. I've done it again. It's going to happen now. just for the audience, there is a tree right next to where I'm recording this and it is, yeah, buckling
teetering.
Slightly. Teetering, yes. But yeah, I mean, that to me, if they've genuinely thought, well, Lukaku's strength is counter-attacking, let's bring him in because he'll add a new dimension to the game, and when Chelsea just won't be counter-attacking against most teams in the division, that does seem a bit foolhardy, to be honest.
Liam, before we move on from Lukaku, is he kind of thinking, well, I'm not getting on with Thomas Tuchel, but this is Chelsea, there'll be another coach along shortly and I'm on a long contract, so I'll probably outlast this guy? Or is there a desire on his part, do you think, to try and fit into what Tuchel's doing? Because he's, you know, we mentioned, and it's at the top of your piece, the latest cryptic social media post. Is he being that forceful with his teammates and with his bosses about what he wants from the team in a way that you would think that a striker of his calibre and his profile would be able to come into a club like Chelsea and say to players, look, this is where I want you to put the ball for me. This is how you're going to get the best out of me.
Well, look, we have no evidence to suggest he's hoping to outlast Tuchel. And if he is, all the signs are that's not a very smart strategy, because Tuchel has the club's backing right now. He's in a very strong position after the Champions League win, even though they've fallen out of title contention this season. All the indications are he will be given at least another summer to kind of get Chelsea in position to genuinely challenge Manchester City and Liverpool. And I also didn't see anything from Lukaku's body language against Palace that suggested he's throwing a strop. You know, that I think you get quite a lot of emotion that creeps into the way fans look at these things, and it's all coloured by that interview. It all starts from, that's the original sin of all of this, and everyone's looking at it through that prism forever. But I didn't see Lukaku looking like Brazilian Ronaldo in the 2006 World Cup, where he's just standing like a bollard in the middle of the pitch, looking, you know, immobile, looking for the ball to feet all the time. He was moving. He was trying to spin into spaces and make runs. It's just not working on a football level. It doesn't seem like as much of a personality issue as a fundamental football issue, a fundamental issue of football fit. And so the question becomes, can Lukaku adapt? Can Chelsea adapt? Can they meet in the middle somewhere? And I've always thought in theory it's possible, but after Palace, I'm just less optimistic than ever that it will actually happen in practice.
Let's finish our chat on this game on a positive, not for you, Dom, but for our listeners at least. Hakim Ziyech scored the winner in the last minute of the game. 3-3 in the Premier League for him now. Is he in the form of his Chelsea career, and is he the first choice of that front three at the moment?
I would say so. It's funny, actually, because, again, Lee and I were chatting during the game, and we were talking about the Palace left-back, Tariq Mitchell. At one point, and Liam did put the mockers on him at one stage, and he made one of his few mistakes in the immediacy of our conversation. But I thought Mitchell was one of Palace's best performers, and yet Ziyech was outstanding on the right flank for Chelsea, and he showed good adaptability. I think he was pretty much playing as a right wing back by the end after the switch in formation following the substitutions. He's confident at the moment. He's playing with a belief again, which is probably stems from regular involvement and this little flurry of goals that he's had. But I thought, yeah, he was highlighted on the highlights programs as well. I thought his delivery was good. He was tenacious. He obviously the finish is fantastic for the winning goal. And yeah, he probably is the one member of that Chelsea front line that currently is playing at the top of their game. Well, certainly he would argue that the best football he's played for Chelsea. I'm sure he played well at Ajax previously. But he's a menace. He's a menace. And yeah, you'd imagine that he would be, you know, fitness permitting, he would definitely start the League Cup final at the weekend, because he is the one that's providing all the bite at the moment.
A League Cup final to come. We'll look at the Champions League next, but that result leaves Chelsea third in the Premier League, and they are 8 points clear of fifth place West Ham with a game in hand. So that's something to look forward to when Chelsea play their next Premier League game, which I think is sometime around the end of May. Okay, next up, we'll look ahead to the return of the Champions League.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
A Chelsea welcome Lille to Stamford Bridge on Tuesday night. The Blues play the first leg of their Champions League last 16 tie against the reigning French champions. Liam, we're talking before Thomas Tuchel addresses the media, but we're guessing that, Mason Mount and Reece James will still be unavailable for this game. But he'll be hoping to have Azpilicueta and maybe Hudson-Odoi back so he can reshuffle that defence and get kind of square pegs in square holes.
Yeah, it looks like Tuchel will at least have the option to return to the back three and go to wing back. So it'll be interesting on a tactical level to see whether he wants to do that or whether he wants to give this back four a bit more of a run. It is too soon for Mount. I mean, the League Cup final is kind of optimistic in terms of his recovery, as fast a healer as he is. But the Lille games is absolutely too soon. Reece James, I just think they don't want to take too many chances with him. He's too important, particularly to the creation of this team. You know, even with Chelsea struggling a little bit, not looking in quite their free-flowing best, you would favour them to get past Lille regardless. They don't have to worry about away goals in this first leg, which is important. So, yeah, I think everything points to giving James as much time as possible to get healthy and then letting him get back to the kind of form that he was in the autumn just before that ankle injury.
People have been kind of throwing shade at Chelsea, Dom, in recent weeks, calling them a deluxe cup team. Does that work in their favour? You know, that they have got this such a good record under Thomas Tuchel in cup competitions. Does that mean that they're amongst the contenders to win the Champions League this time, do you think? Or are they too far away from that because of the issues at the top end of the pitch that we've been talking about?
Well, they won it last year with similar kinds of issues. As defending champions, of course, they're very much in contention. It would depend upon the draw, but I think, you know, on paper, this is quite a kind draw to get through to the quarterfinals. I mean, I think Lille will pose some problems. They've got on paper at least, they've got a talented squad and a creative squad, a lot of experience in there as well. And it's no mean feat for any team to pip Paris Saint-Germain to the Ligue 1 title, which, as they did last year, okay, they haven't followed that up with form to merit that title defence so much this time around, but they will pose a threat. But yeah, Chelsea definitely contenders. I mean, we'd have to see where the draw takes them in the next round if they get through this one, but, you know, that's the nature of cup competitions. But they will have the belief, and they've won every competition they've played since the FA Cup final last season, and they almost won that. So they will definitely be going into this two-legged tie pepped in the belief that they and the conviction that they can retain their title. Yes.
Dom mentions Lille won the league last season. They're ninth at the moment, drew 0-0 at home to Metz on Friday night. They've got a squad which has been put together purely for banter, as far as I can see.
It's amazing.
38-year-old Jose Font, 34-year-old Hatem Ben Arfa, 36-year-old Burak Yilmaz, but also the Man United loanee Angel Gomez, former Chelsea striker George Weah's son Timothy, and I note, Liam, Renato Sanchez, last seen at Stamford Bridge, passing to the Carabao sign. So a shot at redemption for him.
Yeah, I think he's looked a lot better at Lille. He seems to have very much got his career back on track and to the point where big European clubs are looking at him again. So, yeah, he'll be one of the guys I think that Chelsea will be most concerned about stopping. The other one, of course, that, you know, I think Chelsea would have been quite pleased to see leave Lille in January was Sven Botman. It didn't happen in the end, but that would have been nice for them. He's one of the most highly rated centre-backs in Europe right now. And so if there is going to be some sort of upset, you would think that those players are going to be heavily involved for Lille. But this is a diminished squad to the one that won the Ligue 1 title last year. And Chelsea, even struggling as they are in an attacking sense, should have enough to get past them relatively comfortably over two legs.
Dom, we normally save our plugs till the end, but it's apropos to do it now because your piece with Joe Cole about his time at Lille is up on The Athletic now. Tell us a bit more about it, please.
Well, it was a sort of recap with Joe because I went over to see him in Lille in the October time of 2011, when he was a couple of months into his year-long loan from Liverpool, actually, after a very underwhelming first season on Merseyside after leaving Chelsea. And it was great to sort of get his thoughts on that year, because I think it did. At the time, he felt it was sort of rejuvenating in terms of his career, revitalising it all after a very disappointing season, first season at Anfield. Looking back, it was probably a bit of an Indian summer on his career, even though he was only 29, 30 over the course of that season. I'm not sure he ever really hit the heights again after that. And when he went back, his existence became slightly more nomadic, with stints at various different clubs and ending up in the States with Tampa Bay Rowdies. But he had some great thoughts on Ligue 1, who he surprised me by saying that he's convinced that Ligue 1 is the second best league, well, in the world, effectively. I mean, higher than La Liga and higher than Serie A, which, you know, I think might get people debating whether that is the case. But he's pointed to the progress that he witnessed a decade ago, and the building of new stadium, the infrastructure that clubs were putting in place, clubs like Lille. He didn't play at Lille's 50,000-seater stadium. That was being built that year. He played in a stadium that had a capacity of 17,000 as league champions, and yet their training ground, which I visited at the time, was absolutely amazing. It was similar to Cobham in terms of the setup. The stadium is now top-notch, and a number of other clubs in Ligue 1 had done the same, from the biggest clubs in Lyon to the smallest in Valenciennes. So he was talking about the upgrade in the standard, really, and how that's benefited French football domestically in the period since. But he had some... I mean, I'd forgotten that year. So this is in the title defence after Lille had won the Ligue 1 for the first time in, I think, 57 years or something daft. They had Eden Hazard, obviously, at 19-20, playing out of his skin, winning the French League's Player of the Year every year. 16 assists, 20-odd goals that season. They had Dimitri Payet as the other forward in that front three. They had Idrissa Gueye in midfield. They had a young Luca Digne playing at left-back. They had so much quality in that setup. A really, really good team. And in the last year, really, before PSG established this strength and dominance in French football, Carlo Ancelotti came in halfway through that season. That was their opportunity to defend their title and to sort of become one of the great teams in that club's history. Unfortunately, they finished third. They finished slightly off the pace. And it was an Olivier Giroud-inspired Montpellier that actually won the title that season, which is remarkable when you think that PSG had the backing of Qatar already at that stage.
Yeah, really interesting club. They'll be at Stamford Bridge on Tuesday night. We will react to Chelsea versus Lille in the Champions League on Thursday's show.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Elsewhere in Chelsea news, Storm Eunice meant that the Blues' vital PL2 game against Tottenham's under-23s was postponed. In news relating to that squad, Simon reported on Friday that young defender Bashir Humphreys is close to agreeing a new contract. The under-18s game against Reading also called off. A reminder, the FA Youth Cup quarterfinal against Blackpool takes place at Stamford Bridge on Thursday of this week. That's the 24th of February. No game for the women's team. They're on international break. Jess Carter started for England in their goalless draw with Spain on Sunday in the Arnold Clark Cup. Fran Kirby came off the bench in that one. In the same competition, Jessie Fleming, part of the Canada side that beat Germany. She played in the 1-1 draw with England at the Riverside last week, in which Millie Bright starred. Sophie Ingle captained the Wales side that lost on penalties after a goalless draw against Belgium in the semi-final of the Pinatar Cup on Saturday. Alsu Abdelina played for Russia. They beat the Republic of Ireland in a friendly. Guro Reitens, Norway, went down 2-1 to Italy in the Algarve Cup. The women's team back in action on Saturday. They face Leicester in the fifth round of the FA Cup. Before we go then, Liam, other than your Romelu Lukaku piece, what else is on your agenda for this week, please?
So I'm heading down to the Valley on Tuesday night. I've not been there before, actually. That'd be quite fun. To watch Mason Burstow, the 19-year-old striker that Chelsea signed, the big name striker arrival in the January transfer window. I want to get a closer look at him and just see what he's like at League One level. And then I'll just be preparing for the cup final.
Nice. You might get to see Juan Castillo as well. He's on loan at Charlton as well at the moment. What about you, Dom? What's on your to-do list for this week?
Well, I'm hoping to be in attendance at the Lille game on Tuesday. And we are working on an oral history piece on the 2005 League Cup final, Jose Mourinho's first trophy in English football. A recap of Liverpool-Chelsea ahead of Sunday's rematch.
Yeah, really looking forward to that. Thursday's show will be previewing the League Cup final against Liverpool on Sunday. We'll also look back on that game against Lille too. Do join us for that if you can. Until then, from Liam, from Dom and from Lucy, many thanks for your company today. We'll catch up with you later in the week. Bye for now.
The Athletic.